Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Around the globe, there are approximately 60 million people who have been forced to leave their homes to escape war, violence, and persecution. The majority of them have become internally displaced persons, which means they have fled their homes but are still within their own countries. Others have crossed a border and sought shelter outside of their own countries. They are commonly referred to as refugees. But what exactly does that term mean? The world has known refugees for millennia, but the modern definition was drafted in the UN's 1951 convention relating to the status of refugees in response to mass persecutions and displacements of the Second World War. It defines a refugee as someone who is outside their country of nationality and is unable to return to their home country because of well-founded fears of being persecuted. That persecution may be due to their race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion, and is often related to war and violence. Today, roughly half the world's refugees are children, some of them unaccompanied by an adult, a situation that makes them especially vulnerable to child labor or sexual exploitation. Each refugee's story is different, and many must undergo dangerous journeys with uncertain outcomes. But before we get to what their journeys involve, let's clear one thing up. There's a lot of confusion regarding the difference between the terms migrant and refugee. Migrants usually refers to people who leave their country for reasons not related to persecution, such as searching for better economic opportunities or leaving drought-stricken areas in search of better circumstances. There are many people around the world who have been displaced because of natural disasters, food insecurities, and other hardships. But international law, rightly or wrongly, only recognizes those fleeing conflict and violence as refugees. So what happens when someone flees their country? Most refugee journeys are long and perilous, with limited access to shelter, water, or food. Since the departure can be sudden and unexpected, belongings might be left behind, and people who are evading conflict often do not have the required documents like visas to board airplanes and legally enter other countries. Financial and political factors can also prevent them from traveling by standard routes. This means they can usually only travel by land or sea and may need to entrust their lives to smugglers to help them cross borders. Whereas some people seek safety with their families, others attempt passage alone and leave their loved ones behind with the hopes of being reunited later. This separation can be traumatic and unbearably long. While more than half the world's refugees are in cities, sometimes the first stop for a person fleeing conflict is a refugee camp, usually run by the United Nations Refugee Agency or local governments. Refugee camps are intended to be temporary structures, offering short-term shelter until inhabitants can safely return home, be integrated to the host country, or resettle in another country. But resettlement and long-term integration options are often limited. So many refugees are left with no choice but to remain in camps for years and sometimes even decades. Once in a new country, the first legal step for a displaced person is to apply for asylum. At this point, they are an asylum seeker and not officially recognized as a refugee until the application has been accepted. While countries by and large agree on one definition of refugee, every host country is responsible for examining all requests for asylum and deciding whether applicants can be granted the status of refugee. Different countries' guidelines can vary substantially. Host countries have several duties towards people they have recognized as refugees, like the guarantee of a minimum standard of treatment and non-discrimination. The most basic obligation towards refugees is non-refoulement, a principle preventing a nation from sending an individual to a country where their life and freedom are threatened. In reality, however, refugees are frequently the victims of inconsistent and discriminatory treatment. They are increasingly obliged to rebuild their lives in the face of xenophobia and racism. And all too often, they aren't permitted to enter the workforce and are fully dependent on humanitarian aid. In addition, far too many refugee children are out of school due to lack of funding for education programs. If you go back in your own family history, chances are you will discover that at a certain point, your ancestors were forced from their homes, either escaping a war or fleeing discrimination and persecution. It would be good of us to remember their stories when we hear of refugees currently displaced, searching for a new home.
I apologize for rambling at the front of that video, friends. You did bark at me.
Oh.
Well, we're rambling, talking over here.
I thought he normally says good morning. It's time to
start.
Yeah.
You didn't have the right start.
And Ann gets up and leaves us like, you know, like we're playing over here.
How do you write sitting between two men?
I'm just lucky.
She got up, she wasn't so, here.
That's subjective.
Yeah. So I started with that video, which you had a link to in the Covenant Corner on Tuesday. So if you did your homework, you've already seen it. Because it's not the main video, but it puts some terms around what we'll be talking about today. So if you didn't pay attention, you don't know the terms. And if you did pay attention, you may still not know the terms. So we're going to be talking about refugees today. This was a topic that when we asked for what are y'all interested in last spring, that was one of the topics that was suggested. Obviously, questions surrounding refugees and some of the related categories of people's situations are very much in the public conversation. So as we look at issues for faithful voters, that's the idea for the next few weeks. We wanted to spend a little bit of time with what does it mean to be a refugee, and what's going on around the situations that refugees find themselves in. So the gist of this video you didn't watch is that the word refugee and other related terms have actually very specific technical meanings. So there are two terms that get very commonly sort of interchanged with each other, and a third term, third and fourth term that matter. So the video drew a distinction between refugee and migrant. And a migrant is anyone who travels from one place to another for essentially any reason. A refugee is a very specific category of person. A refugee is someone who is outside their country of nationality. I am fairly confident that everyone in the room is a United States citizen, so the U.S. is our country of nationality. If we were to travel outside the United States for a particular reason, we might be identified as refugees. The particular reason is fleeing war or violence. This is part of the United Nations definition of refugee. So it's a very specific pair of criteria that apply here. Traveling outside your country of nationality in order to flee war or violence. If you have not left your country of nationality, but you are fleeing war or violence, you are an internally displaced person. The rules and legalities are a little bit different around being an internally displaced person versus being a refugee. The fourth term that gets used in this process is asylum seeker. An asylum seeker is someone who has made application to be identified as a refugee. There are some complications in the process of that we need to understand as we are thinking about refugees. There are complications in the process of becoming a refugee. One is that you have to be an asylum seeker before you can be a refugee, because you are an asylum seeker during the time that your request for asylum is being adjudicated by whichever country you have applied to. The other issue is that refugees typically do not have, because of the situations that lead them to leaving their homes, refugees typically don't have access to the kind of documentation that would allow them to enter a country through other sort of conventional sort of legal migration channels. So if you're entering a country because you're seeking work there, or you're entering a country because you have work there, that is a different process and depends on documentation that refugees typically do not have, or asylum seekers as they present themselves at the border. Let's get this on the table, presenting yourself at a border crossing is the legal way to seek asylum. That is what seeking asylum is to present yourself at a border crossing and say, I'm fleeing violence or war and need refuge in your country. So that was the video you didn't watch just now. The video you also didn't watch getting ready for today, your further viewing, brings sort of those ideas and the ideas that we'll see in our main video and brings them very specifically to the question of what's going on at the southwestern border of the United States. And this is a video from March 2019. Again, that link was in your Covenant Corner on Tuesday. Identifying essentially what's going on, who are the folks who are seeking asylum at the southwest border of the United States. So just some key facts that might be helpful for you. They're not related to, not directly related to the points of the main video that we'll watch in just a moment now that I have all your attention.
Poor Warren.
As if Warren was the only person talking.
Yeah.
So Melanie Nezer explains sort of key points you need to know about the situation at the southwest border of the United States. First, most immigrants at the southern United States land crossings come from three countries: Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. They are some of the most violent countries in the world. Statistically speaking, the conditions in country and the conditions that are leading people to need to leave those countries to flee war or violence. Notice that that's the specific categories of refugees. The reasons that they need to leave are linked to the civil wars of the 1980s in those countries in which the United States was deeply involved. I will state that in those neutral terms. The recent difference is that increasingly we are seeing families with children fleeing from those countries and seeking asylum in the United States. So the identities of those who are seeking asylum, that's different. The number of people seeking asylum is actually not that much higher especially the numbers of those being sort of intercepted trying to cross the border at not checkpoints, is not all that much higher. And remember, it is legal to seek asylum. It is legal to seek asylum. So that's applying some of these principles to the situation at the southwest border. I wanted to zoom out a little bit from that, and so I have for us a talk from February of 2016. Alexander Betts is our speaker this morning, and he is laying out some of the fundamental problems with the international refugee system. And he's speaking primarily from a European context. And so you'll recognize perhaps some of the situations that apply maybe more in Europe than in the United States, although replace the Mediterranean Sea with the Sonoran Desert, and you're not that far off. So, fundamental problems with the international refugee system and changes that would make the system more humane and effective. That's where we're going with today's talk.
I can't remember the four terms you defined early on. I got three of them.
Okay.
The four again?
Okay, so refugee,
okay.
Which is someone who is outside their country of nationality, fleeing war or violence. There is internally displaced person, that's someone who is still within their country of nationality.
That's what I missed. Internally displaced person. Give me. Okay.
And asylum seeker is someone who has applied for asylum, but that request has not yet been adjudicated so that they can officially become a refugee. And then migrant is a broader term that doesn't have necessarily that fleeing war or violence attached.
So the internally displaced person, that's an American that's in the lower 48, but doesn't really have a home?
So it typically doesn't apply to Americans because we're typically not fleeing war or violence or even natural disaster. But you could make the argument that those who are fleeing natural disaster, lived in a town that was wiped out by a hurricane.
New Orleans.
Right. So I think you could categorize them as internally displaced persons. But think in a think for instance in Syria. That's actually sort of the sending country that Alexander Betts will primarily be talking about, because again he's in Europe. Someone lived in Homs, Syria, and has left that city because it was under attack.
Okay.
If they're at a camp in Syria, they are an internally displaced person.
That helps.
If they're at a camp in Lebanon, they're a refugee.
Yes.
And is a migrant the same as an immigrant?
Migrant sort of takes the in or out prefix off, but yeah, someone who has moved from one place to another, and they could be seeking economic opportunity. They could be fleeing from a natural disaster. So if someone someone who lived in the Bahamas and came to the United States after the hurricane, they would not be categorized as a refugee because they're not fleeing war or violence, they're fleeing natural disaster. So migrant you would use as a broader term, although you wouldn't typically apply the word migrant to a refugee. So it's complicated. And under international law, the term refugee does not apply to those who are fleeing natural disaster. That may be a hole in that definition. It depends on how you want to, how you want to think about that. But at the level of fact, international law defines refugee in that specific way.
Okay, here's what's wrong with the refugee system and how to fix it.
There are times when I feel really quite ashamed to be a European. In the last year, more than 1 million people arrived in Europe in need of our help, and our response, frankly, has been pathetic. There are just so many contradictions. We mourn the tragic death of 2-year-old Aylan Kurdi, and yet, Since then, more than 200 children have subsequently drowned in the Mediterranean. We have international treaties that recognize that refugees are a shared responsibility. And yet, we accept that tiny Lebanon hosts more Syrians than the whole of Europe combined. We lament the existence of human smugglers, and yet we make that the only viable route to seek asylum in Europe. We have labor shortages, and yet we exclude people who fit our economic and demographic needs from coming to Europe. We proclaim our liberal values in opposition to fundamentalist Islam, and yet we have repressive policies that detain child asylum seekers, that separate children from their families, and that seize property from refugees. What are we doing? How has the situation come to this, that we've adopted such an inhumane response to a humanitarian crisis? I don't believe it's because people don't care, or at least I don't want to believe it's because people don't care. I believe it's because our politicians lack a vision for how to adapt an international refugee system created over 50 years ago for a changing and globalized world. And so what I want to do is take a step back and ask two really fundamental questions. The two questions we all need to ask. First, why is the current system not working? And second, what can we do to fix it? So the modern refugee regime was created in the aftermath of the Second World War by these guys. Its basic aim is to ensure that when a state fails, or worse, turns against its own people, people have somewhere to go, to live in safety and dignity until they can go home. It was created precisely for situations like the situation we see in Syria today. Through an international convention signed by 147 governments, the 1951 Convention on the Status of Refugees, and an international organization, UNHCR, states committed to reciprocally admit people onto their territory who flee conflict and persecution. But today, that system is failing. In theory, refugees have a right to seek asylum. In practice, our immigration policies block the path to safety. In theory, refugees have a right to a pathway to integration or return to the country they've come from. But in practice, they get stuck in almost indefinite limbo. In theory, refugees are a shared global responsibility. In practice, geography means that countries proximate to conflict take the overwhelming majority of the world's refugees. The system isn't broken because the rules are wrong. It's that we're not applying them adequately to a changing world. And that's what we need to reconsider. So I want to explain to you a little bit about how the current system works. How does the refugee regime actually work? But not from a top-down institutional perspective, rather from the perspective of a refugee. So imagine a Syrian woman. Let's call her Amira. And Amira, to me, represents many of the people I've met in the region. Amira, like around 25% of the world's refugees, is a woman with children. And she can't go home because she comes from this city that you see before you, Homs, a once beautiful and historic city, now under rubble, and so Amira can't go back there. But Amira also has no hope of resettlement to a third country, because that's a lottery ticket only available to less than 1% of the world's refugees. So Amira and her family face an almost impossible choice. They have three basic options. The first option is that Amira can take her family to a camp. In the camp, she might get assistance, but there are very few prospects for Amira and her family. Camps are in bleak, arid locations, often in the desert. In the Zaatari refugee camp in Jordan, you can hear the shells across the border in Syria at nighttime. There's restricted economic activity. Education is often of poor quality. And around the world, some 80% of refugees who are in camps have to stay for at least 5 years. It's a miserable existence. And that's probably why, in reality, Only 9% of Syrians choose that option. Alternatively, Amira can head to an urban area in a neighboring country, like Amman or Beirut. That's an option that about 75% of Syrian refugees have taken. But there's great difficulty as well. Refugees in such urban areas don't usually have the right to work. They don't usually get significant access to assistance. And so when Amira and her family have used up their basic savings, they're left with very little and likely to face urban destitution. So there's a third alternative, and it's one that increasing numbers of Syrians are taking. Amira can seek some hope for her family by risking their lives on a dangerous and perilous journey to another country. And it's that which we're seeing in Europe today. Around the world, we present refugees with an almost impossible choice between three options: encampment, urban destitution, and dangerous journeys. For refugees, that choice is the global refugee regime today. But I think it's a false choice. I think we can reconsider that choice. The reason why we limit those options is because we think that those are the only options that are available to refugees, and they're not. Politicians frame the issue as a zero-sum issue, that if we benefit refugees, we're imposing costs on citizens. We tend to have a collective assumption that refugees are an inevitable cost or burden to society, but they don't have to, they can contribute. So what I want to argue is there are ways in which we can expand that choice set and still benefit everyone else, the host states and communities, our societies, and refugees themselves. And I want to suggest four ways in which we can transform the paradigm of how we think about refugees. All four ways have one thing in common. They're all ways in which we take the opportunities of globalization, mobility and markets, and update the way we think about the refugee issue. The first one I want to think about is the idea of enabling environments. And it starts from a very basic recognition that refugees are human beings like everyone else, but they're just in extraordinary circumstances. Together with my colleagues in Oxford, we've embarked on a research project in Uganda, looking at the economic lives of refugees. We chose Uganda not because it's representative of all host countries. It's not. It's exceptional. Unlike most host countries around the world, what Uganda has done is give refugees economic opportunity. It gives them the right to work. It gives them freedom of movement. And the results of that are extraordinary, both for refugees and the host community. In the capital city, Kampala, we found that 21% of refugees own a business that employs other people. And 40% of those employees are nationals of the host country. In other words, refugees are making jobs for citizens of the host country. Even in the camps, we found extraordinary examples of vibrant, flourishing, and entrepreneurial businesses. For example, in a settlement called Nakivale, we found examples of Congolese refugees running digital music exchange businesses. We found a Rwandan who runs a business that's available to allow the youth to play computer games on recycled games consoles and recycled televisions. Against the odds of extreme constraint, refugees are innovating. And the gentleman you see before you is a Congolese guy called Demu K. Demu K arrived in the settlement with very little, but he wanted to be a filmmaker. So with friends and colleagues, he started a community radio station. He rented a video camera, and he's now making films. He made two documentary films with and for our team, and he's making a successful business out of very little. It's those kinds of examples that should guide our response to refugees. Rather than seeing refugees as inevitably dependent upon humanitarian assistance, we need to provide them with opportunities for human flourishing. Yes, clothes, blankets, shelter, food are all important in the emergency phase, but we need to also look beyond that. We need to provide opportunities to connectivity, electricity, education, the right to work, access to capital and banking. All the ways in which we take for granted that we are plugged into the global economy can and should apply to refugees. The second idea I want to discuss is economic zones. Unfortunately, not every host country in the world takes the approach Uganda has taken. Most host countries don't open up their economies to refugees in the same way. But there are still pragmatic alternative options that we can use. Last April, I traveled to Jordan with my colleague, the development economist Paul Collier. And we brainstormed an idea while we were there with the international community and the government, an idea to bring jobs to Syrians while supporting Jordan's national development strategy. The idea is for an economic zone, one in which we could potentially integrate the employment of refugees alongside the employment of Jordanian host nationals. And just 15 minutes away from the Zaatari refugee camp, home to 83,000 refugees, is an existing economic zone called the King Hussein bin Talal Development Area. The government has spent over $100 million connecting it to the electricity grid, connecting it to the road network, but it lacked two things: access to labor and inward investment. So what if refugees were able to work there rather than being stuck in camps, able to support their families and develop skills through vocational training before they go back to Syria? We recognize that that could benefit Jordan, whose development strategy requires it to make the leap as a middle-income country to manufacturing. It could benefit refugees, but it could also contribute to the post-conflict reconstruction of Syria by recognizing that we need to incubate refugees as the best source of eventually rebuilding Syria. We published the idea in the journal Foreign Affairs. King Abdullah has picked up on the idea. It was announced at the London Syria conference 2 weeks ago, and the pilot will begin in the summer. The third idea that I want to put to you is preference matching between states and refugees to lead to the kinds of happy outcomes you see here in the selfie featuring Angela Merkel and a Syrian refugee. What we rarely do is ask refugees what they want, where they want to go. But I'd argue we can do that and still make everyone better off. The economist Alvin Roth developed the idea of matching markets, ways in which the preference ranking of the parties shapes an eventual match. My colleagues Will Jones and Alex Teitelboim have explored ways in which that idea could be applied to refugees, to ask refugees to rank their preferred destinations, but also allow states to rank the types of refugees they want on skills criteria or language criteria and allow those to match. Now, of course, you'd need to build in quotas on things like diversity and vulnerability, but it's a way of increasing the possibilities of matching. The matching idea has been successfully used to match, for instance, students with university places, to match kidney donors with patients, and it underlies the kind of algorithms that exist on dating websites. So why not apply that to give refugees greater choice? It could also be used at the national level, where one of the great challenges we face is to persuade local communities to accept refugees. And at the moment, in my country, for instance, we often send engineers to rural areas and farmers to the cities, which makes no sense at all. So matching markets offer a potential way to bring those preferences together and listen to the needs and demands of the populations that host and the refugees themselves. The fourth idea I want to put to you is of humanitarian visas. Much of the tragedy and chaos we've seen in Europe was entirely avoidable. It stems from a fundamental contradiction in Europe's asylum policy, which is the following: that in order to seek asylum in Europe, you have to arrive spontaneously by embarking on those dangerous journeys that I described. But why should those journeys be necessary in an era of the budget airline and modern consular capabilities? They're completely unnecessary journeys, and last year they led to the deaths of over 3,000 people on Europe's borders and within European territory. If refugees were simply allowed to travel directly and seek asylum in Europe, we would avoid that. And there's a way of doing that through something called a humanitarian visa that allows people to collect a visa at an embassy or a consulate in a neighboring country and then simply pay their own way through a ferry or a flight to Europe. It costs around 1,000 euros to take a smuggler from Turkey to the Greek islands. It costs 200 euros to take a budget airline from Bodrum to Frankfurt. If we allowed refugees to do that, it would have major advantages. It would save lives. It would undercut the entire market for smugglers. And it would remove the chaos we see from Europe's front line in areas like the Greek islands. It's politics that prevents us doing that, rather than a rational solution. And this is an idea that has been applied. Brazil has adopted a pioneering approach where over 2,000 Syrians have been able to get humanitarian visas, enter Brazil, and claim refugee status on arrival in Brazil. And in that scheme, every Syrian who's gone through it has received refugee status and been recognized as a genuine refugee. There's a historical precedent for it as well. Between 1922 and 1942, these Nansen passports were used as travel documents to allow 450,000 Assyrians, Turks, and Chechens to travel across Europe and claim refugee status elsewhere in Europe. And the Nansen International Refugee Office received the Nobel Peace Prize in recognition of this being a viable strategy. So all four of these ideas that I've presented you are ways in which we can expand Amira's choice set. They're ways in which we can have greater choice for refugees beyond those basic, impossible three options I explained to you, and still leave others better off. In conclusion, we really need a new vision, a vision that enlarges the choices of refugees, but recognizes that they don't have to be a burden. There's nothing inevitable about refugees being a cost. Yes, they are a humanitarian responsibility, but they're human beings with skills, talents, aspirations, with the ability to make contributions if we let them. In the new world, migration is not going to go away. What we've seen in Europe will be with us for many years. People will continue to travel. They'll continue to be displaced. And we need to find rational, realistic ways of managing this, not based on the old logics of humanitarian assistance, not based on logics of charity, but building on the opportunities offered by globalization, markets, and mobility. I'd urge you all to wake up and urge our politicians to wake up to this challenge. Thank you very much.
Before we begin, Ikram.
Yeah.
This is our pastor at the first Arabic Presbyterian Church here in Des Moines. Was she a refugee?
Yes.
Yes, she was.
Mm-hmm.
From?
She is from, well, it was Sudan at the time. She's actually from the north side of the line.
Right.
The majority of her congregation is from what is now South Sudan, although this was during a civil war.
Terrible.
And so where you're from is a little complicated in that kind of story.
She's quite a story.
Yes, and her story sort of brings her to us by way of Egypt and Lebanon, and I believe there's another country along the way, and then the United States. So these refugee journeys are long and complicated, and involve some utterly amazing people. I'm sure she would be able to tell you more about these three awful options, right? That Betts lays out for us, the three options of encampment, or destitution in an urban area, where you're not permitted to work and earn money, or dangerous land or sea journeys. You have to be on the ground, the way that the refugee laws are written. Which is not to say that there are not sort of, once you've slowly sort of percolated your way through the process, if you're being resettled, you can eventually perhaps arrive by air. But the process of getting there involves all of these are all dangerous in their own way, situations. So Betts offers us four ways to transform that paradigm. Economic opportunity, the right to work, and freedom of movement. For instance, the approach taken in Uganda, where Refugees are able to own businesses that create jobs for Ugandan nationals. You caught that? Economic zones, making use of the labor pool of refugees, and also incubating skills among them so that when it's time to go back and rebuild the country that the majority of refugees really would love to be able to return to their home country. There's somewhere to go.
That's pretty loud.
Snatching between where refugees would like to go and what characteristics of refugees receiving countries would look
for. Hello.
And humanitarian visas for direct travel by air. And he cited the statistic, over 3,000 deaths in and at the borders of Europe in 2015 because of these land and sea journeys. So what would that look like? What would an approach that enlarges refugees' choices and allows that they don't have to be a burden on their receiving country, what would that look like in the United States? Imagine.
I think one of the things you have to get rid of is the thought, I guess, or the premise that people coming over the border want to take everybody's jobs. So when Americans are looking at people coming from the Mexico and the countries you're talking about, and they say, well, if we let them work, then they're going to take away Americans' jobs, without realizing that the jobs that they're very happy to take are ones that most Americans don't want to begin with.
Yeah, so
but it's an attitude, and I think it's difficult to get past that.
So there's the question of whether the receiving of refugees is a zero-sum question. And how do we approach that as not a zero-sum question, but rather a question that can be mutually beneficial? One of the things we have to do in order to allow that it's mutually beneficial is to also allow that there are also drawbacks, right? That this economic calculus is in fact complicated. But that's not to say that that it's complicated to everyone's detriment, right? So it has been, research has found that the more immigration tends to drive down the wages of very low wage jobs. It has also been found that if you are hiring people who are not legally documented as having a legal right to work in the country, that drives those wages way down, right? Which raises for me the question of, especially as he's describing in the refugee process, there's this period of time when you are not yet permitted to work, right? You're permitted to be in the country and not yet permitted to work. What does that do to the process, right? So it's a complicated choice, and it's not zero sum on either side. But to find ways of talking about the benefits, the needs, the assets, the drawbacks, all at the same time, allows us then to maybe have a conversation that says, there's opportunity. What would that opportunity look like? What would a mutually beneficial opportunity look like in the United States?
I think some of it would look like Storm Lake.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where the Hispanic or Latino immigrants have come in and basically regenerated that area.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I've read recently is with all of the crackdown on even people with green cards or that are legitimately here, mm-hmm. that there's still the concern that all of a sudden ICE is going to come in and take them away. They did in southern Iowa. I can't remember what town. Mount Pleasant.
Yeah. ICE has, if you will pardon the expression, a chilling effect on sort of the sense of freedom of movement of sort of anyone who could reasonably, anyone who could potentially be identified as an immigrant of some flavor. And ICE is kind of verifiably messy in the way that their enforcement actions work. Which is not to say that there shouldn't be enforcement. We could get other videos to talk about how this particular enforcement regime is broken and has been broken for 20 some years. ICE has only existed for about 15 years, but the American immigration enforcement regime has been broken for a very long time.
We've also been bombarded with the thoughts that people coming into our country are murderers and rapists and criminals.
So what would it look like, not just to change that conversation, I mean, there are pieces of that conversation that just simply need to be called out, right? That need to be called out, for instance, with I almost said that wrong. The thing that we have is documentation that both violent and nonviolent crime are in fact lower among immigrant and refugee communities than among the population at large. That's the facts. That's the problem at the factual level. But there's also, remember we were talking last month about how we talk across these differences, and one of the things that we said is that arguing about the facts doesn't change any minds, right? So that's factually false, and arguing about the fact that that's false is a problem. So we all want safety for our families. We need to get at what's underneath that. What would providing economic opportunity in the context of the refugee system look like in Iowa?
I know you're talking about the U.S., but I'm puzzled with this Jordanian comments, because before the Syrian war, the Jordanians were at about 5% unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
Then with the refugees coming in, it went up to about 25.
Mm-hmm.
And the king was faced with stabilization issues with the government. I mean, uh-huh. high unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And the building, I think what he's talking about, the economic development center that he was referring to, was actually being built to be the new Pentagon. And the king said, no, we need to turn this into a training center for IT.
Oh.
Because I've got 20-some percent unemployment, I got to get down.
Right.
And they're also still holding a lot of them on the border. They will not let them cross.
Mm-hmm.
That 83,000 sitting there is not by choice.
Right.
And they actually have a fence where they pass the food over into that camp, from what Brett tells me. I don't know how true it is, and he may. I don't know if it's been there or not. But the magnitude can play into this a little bit. Now,
if you
overwhelm the current country's system,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that's the case for the U.S., but I get a little nervous sometimes when I
see the CDs
putting out information. It's probably right, but maybe it's not flavored quite right.
So the scale of dealing with 83,000 people in camp.
I mean, it's a small country.
Right.
And they get a lot of aid from the United States.
Right. So what struck me was the way he identified the disconnect between an economic opportunity zone that doesn't have resident labor and talent right next to a residence full of labor and talent. That it takes work to match those, right?
But, and he was forced into it.
Right.
I mean, it's a refugee center. We had the Palestinians in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
Now you've got the Syrians.
Right. So these regional instabilities are...
So it's not quite... It's not an apples and oranges. U.S. was becoming OMG, it doesn't seem to be the magnitude. I'm just but I was a little troubled with the city of the way.
Fair.
And the people, I guess, as he's talking about this, it reminds me of the people in at least in the countries in the Middle East and maybe all over the world, is when they are in the country and they have a child, that child is not a citizen of that country. Remains a citizen of the country.
John Sproul.
Parents.
You please mute this
microphone. I don't know if that makes a lot of difference in all this or not, but they never.
Oh, you're saying that if a Syrian goes to a different country in Europe,
right,
that when they have a child, that's not a citizen.
Well, I don't know about all the countries in Europe. I know in the Middle East.
Oh, in the Middle East.
You know, that's why the Palestinians were such a, they never absorb into the country because they're always.
They're always
Palestinians.
So, yes, so citizenship is a complicated piece of this whole process. And partly because of different, differing rules about sort of how you become a citizen of a country, either a country that you move into or a country that you're born in. There's also for refugee communities that are in a place for a long time, as for instance the Sudanese and South Sudanese refugees in the Des Moines area, there's a generational difference between a refugee generation that really would love to go back and may not feel that there's opportunity or safety to, but would be very happy to, and their children who don't know that country. So this is complicated stuff. I don't pretend that in the 55 minutes, because I started the video on time, that's why I started the video on time. The 55 minutes that we have, I don't pretend that we are going to solve this, but I wanted to complicate the conversation. So,
you did well.
Thank you. Next week we get hunger, so don't eat anything between now and then, and you'll be ready to discuss.
Funny man. You really kind of bothered me.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.